What's going on, everybody? This is Matt from The Tangent. Today's episode is actually longer than 30 minutes. So if you are listening on the radio, you will hear the 30 minutes. However, you will have the opportunity to download it in full as a podcast later on. And I will remind you of that at the end of the episode. I hope you enjoy this week's episode of The Tangent.
My name is Matthew Sparazza.
I'm Father Sam Kachuba. Welcome to The Tangent. I can't believe you did it again. You beat me. You beat me to the punch. It's great.
I'm going out of my way. This is a little competition we have going on. Nobody is keeping score. That's for sure. Least of all, either one of us.
Well, no. The unfortunate thing is, actually, I am keeping score, and you've been winning. That's the problem. And bothering me that I'm losing. Yeah. And maybe the fact that it's bothering me, and that there's this desire for me to win. Maybe our special guest can help me with today, Dr. Jerry Creed.
Yes, no doubt.
Welcome to The Tangent. So happy to have you on.
Nice to be here. I will help as best as I can.
All right, perfect. Thank you, Dr. Jerry, for dealing with our first and certainly not going to be our last inside joke.
Now, you're the author of a great book, Litanies of the Heart, just out now. And it's been my Lenten reading, so thank you very much. I really appreciate it. It's been a great thing to accompany me. As I say that, I then also have to confess that I haven't finished the book yet, but I figure that's okay. I'm working through it. There's great litanies that you include in there for prayer. But you're doing something I think very, very important, which is you're bringing the psychological sciences into and integrating them with solid Catholic principles and spirituality to help people towards greater healing. So tell us a little bit about just the genesis of the book and how we got to this point.
Yeah, I'm happy to. Well, you mentioned the litanies themselves. So those prayers were something that I started to write a few years ago. And with the help of a ministry at Souls and Hearts, which is, you know, a Catholic resource, a Catholic website with blogs and all sorts of things in it. But the community there helped support me actually to fine-tune those prayers. And the prayers themselves were based on attachment theory, which is you know, fairly popular now, and it's getting to be more well-known psychological theory around how we attach as infants, and then how that plays out throughout our lives, really speaks to our insecurities and why some of us withdraw and some of us become anxious and in relationships. And so what occurred to me was, what would it be like to write some kind of prayer that would engage someone so that they would begin from their place of insecurity and move throughout the prayer into a secure attachment with Christ, to be able to develop that kind of foundational relationship with Christ and with the self ultimately, so that, you know, that would then improve, you know, relationships with others and get us out of our insecurity. So the book actually began with those prayers. And then from there, it kind of had a journey of its own as I was just trying to bring together so much of my own clinical practice over the last few decades, so much of what I've learned, so much of what I've experienced, and I really wanted to provide something that people could access, you know, even if they have a counselor, or maybe they don't need to see a counselor, but that would help them on their journey and bring all this wisdom together.
Hmm. So do you view the book as an instruction manual for spiritual directors, for counselors? Is this for people to work through their own things? Because I'm reading it, and I did a certification with the Catholic Psych Institute in their Catholic Psych Model of Applied Personalism with a friend of the show, Dr. Greg Bataro. From now on, we refer to you also, Dr. Jerry, as friend of the show, Dr. Jerry Crete. So awesome. Congratulations. Yeah, yes. It's an illustrious group.
We'll be sending you a medal in the mail.
With the certificate?
Yeah.
No doubt.
Naturally.
Yeah.
But anyway, So I've been reading it both like on an instructional level, like this is helping me to sort of grow in some of these techniques that I might be able to help somebody with. But I'm also seeing a lot of stuff that is just making me pause and reflect. So did you have an intention with it being more for just the average reader to pick up and help them, or for somebody in more of a guidance accompanying role?
Yeah, I really tried hard to write this for the average person. Okay. And so I really try to, you know, provide those little vignettes at the beginning to help draw them in terms of a little bit of a story. Mm-hmm. I wanted to give a little taste of the psychology. I wanted to do a little biblical study, and then to have the prayers themselves, like, sort of experiential with the discussion questions, kind of imagining maybe just a group of people coming together, perhaps even to talk about it. So that was my intention. The problem I have is I can't help myself. And I, you know, I'm holding a lot inside. I tried to keep some of the more technical things into the footnotes or into the appendices in case it's just, I didn't want to bog people down. But I also thought that people, helpers, you know, spiritual directors, coaches, counselors, would benefit a lot from the book as well, and that they could go a little deeper in, you know, in the background if they wanted to, or providing resources for them to find if they wanted to find out more. So, you know, the answer is I really wanted it to hit the average person, but I actually do believe it would really help people who are accompanying others.
Yeah.
Yeah, I noticed that, and I also haven't read the whole book yet, which I sincerely apologize for. But
it just came out. It just came out in mid-January, so yeah, you are okay.
But you do go out of your way to talk about how it's not a replacement for therapy. Mm-hmm. And so I guess a clarifying question would be just where's the line? You know, like who? Because if it's for the average Joe, right? Like surely some of the average Joes should be actually emailing you and like setting up an appointment rather than just going through the book, you know? So where's the line there?
Yeah. I mean, I think that I would say though, first, that I believe some level of counseling or coaching and therapy even perhaps would help anybody.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
You know, any layperson, any clergy, anybody would benefit. I think it should be part of our basic mental health hygiene. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe we don't need to see somebody twice a week or anything, perhaps, but on some regular basis or for some period of time, and then to have somebody you can check in with. So first of all, I would just say that about counseling in general.
Right, fair enough.
There's a problem that there just aren't enough counselors, I think, to go around for everyone to do that at this point. But to answer your question more specifically, if you're going through the exercises and you're finding that you're being very, very triggered. You're not really able to settle into the exercises. You're finding that you're finding that the book isn't going to be enough. It may be a support, but all kinds of deeper issues are coming up for you that maybe you haven't resolved. Then, you know, to me, it would be worthwhile to set up an appointment and see somebody that you can talk through those things with.
Right.
I think a lot of people would have it as a companion. If they already have a counselor, this would be a great companion to that.
Right. Do you think that, and this is perhaps a little bit of a tangent, here we go. Do you think that there's still a stigma like around therapy? Hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think, because listen, anytime I go on YouTube, which I'm not supposed to do because I'm doing Exodus 90, so I'm breaking my Exodus 90 regularly.
Wait, is it for work? If it's for work, it doesn't count.
It's not for work. Okay. It's to watch highlights from sports.
I thank you for your honesty.
Yeah. Exodus 90 did that too, actually. No, but I think it's because I'm 26, right? So I think I'm getting, you know, targeted for my age. The ad that pops up most commonly is BetterHelp, you know? And so, I don't know anything about BetterHelp, so this is not a plug for BetterHelp.
They don't sponsor the show.
Critique of BetterHelp. But, you know, you see that, like, it seems to me that stigma around therapy seems to have decreased a little bit. But I don't know. What, like, as the therapist, what's your view from the 10,000 foot, you know, view?
Well, I would say it has changed a lot, actually, especially among younger demographics. So I work a lot with men. So I would say 80% of clients I work with are male, and sometimes I'm seeing couples. But among the men, like the guys in their 20s and early 30s, I don't find they have much stigma. They're happy. They set up their own appointments. They look forward to counseling. They are happy to get into it, at least the ones that I'm working with in general. Whereas the guys that are more my age, so any guys in their like 40s, 50s, 60s, and maybe later 40s, 50s, 60s, come with a lot of stigma. A lot of times they're coming to therapy because their wife told them they need to or else, you know, or something like, are they, their situation just so dire that they really just, you know, maybe they've been told for multiple quarters they need help or they realize it.
Right.
But, so there's an, I think there is a generational difference, but there's also a societal shift, I think, in general toward, seeing counseling at least as just an, a necessary part of life, you know, and especially I think with COVID, there's been so much anxiety and there's so much depression that, I think we're just realizing we need support with that.
Well, let me ask you a related question then with, in terms of priests. I don't know if you've seen priests very much in your practice, but I know something that for a lot of us as priests, the concern is that if I say, I need some help, that there is going to be the stigma of somehow I'm dealing with an addiction, or somehow I'm not well. And part of that I think might come from the fact that, sadly, if a priest is accused of something, the first stop is to be sent to a treatment facility where they will be evaluated psychologically. So the thought, if I admit that I'm struggling with something, is it going to be put into that category? So I think we, like as priests, sometimes ruminate too much, go off the rails a little bit with the train of thought that's going to take us down the wrong path. But do you ever find priests struggling to seek out that help?
I know that I work with actually a fair number of priests and religious. I love working with clergy. I almost put it as a specialty, something that and I enjoy so much. I would say if anyone needs a counselor, a good Catholic counselor, it is a Catholic priest.
Yeah.
Or because there's so much pressure, you know, in diocesan priests, there's so much pressure, and there's so many skills are being forced to take, you know, to exercise that were never probably part of what they intended to do when they thought about ministry, running a parish. It's almost like you're a small CEO and you're dealing with all sorts of financial things, administrative things and fundraising and these poor guys. Yeah. And then they're often living sometimes alone in a rectory or they're pretty isolated and, you know, they don't have a lot of support. They can't be friends in the normal sense with their parishioners, and it might be difficult to maintain friendships outside of that because their schedules are so busy that if anybody needs some help, I would say it's our priests. Like, it's so important to protect them.
You know, this is a thing that I actually really want to get into with this whole idea of the diocesan priest in particular being asked to take on stuff that wasn't in the It wasn't in the seminary. That wasn't the formation that was received. That's not the point of the priesthood. But it becomes like necessary tasks to keep a parish running. And then there's limits because of our ecclesiology, because of how we understand the governing function of the church, and rightly so, that governance is connected to orders and has to be. Holy orders has to be part of that. But there's a huge question mark as to what can we share with other people? What can be delegated out to people who are better equipped, better trained, and better able to handle those things. This is a huge area that I want to really study it. And I'm a pastor, so I don't have time to study it. But I really want to like break that down, because I think this is a huge area where priests, I know I struggle with this myself. A huge thing that was helpful for me though, and I completely agree with you that priests need this kind of support in mental health, whether it's counseling and therapy or just some kind of accountability and accompaniment. It's so, so necessary. One of the great gifts that I had in the Catholic Psych Model of Applied Personalism certification that I did was finding that support. I can tell you, you're absolutely right. To have somebody that you can talk to and to work on your own challenges, your own issues. Man, it makes such a difference. And that's like not just to have a spiritual director. I think we should all have spiritual directors too. But like to have somebody who can also help you to process sometimes what's going on that psychological, emotional level that maybe your spiritual director doesn't fully have the toolkit to deal with.
Right. And the aspect of confidentiality is so important. Yeah. And so for the priest to feel like, you know, this isn't going back to the bishop, or this isn't going back to anybody. And and they're a little outside of the realm of the church. Like, you know, I'm a Catholic and everything, but I am not, you know, I'm not hired by the church. I'm not working for the church. And so I can bring some objectivity to it. And of course, the mental health perspective, but really to create a space that's a little bit private, that is totally private, and that is an objective kind of sounding board, even. You know, as a priest are dealing with different issues that, that may be coming up, whether that is around addiction or whether that is maybe relationships that are, if they're slightly on the verge of being, you know, crossing a boundary or anything like that, that that would be a difficult thing to talk about. And yet they need that space somewhere where they can, and they know they won't be judged and it won't go anywhere.
Yeah. And also where they can be, they can find the healing. Cause man, I'll tell you, if a priest is on the wrong side of something, he knows it. And if he's a good priest, he doesn't want it. He doesn't want to be on the wrong side, right? So he's trying to correct it, but he needs somebody who can help him to correct it without worrying that the fact that he needs to make an adjustment, that he needs to correct something, that he needs to repair what's broken, is going to completely destroy everything. And yeah, that's a huge piece. Well, I'm really excited about this, that that you've got a heart for doing this with priests. Again, that was a piece that came up for me as I went through the certification, to want to work with priests and to like want to make this available to them, and to make some kind of just some kind of help, some kind of support really available to them, and to work with priests to help them to find that. What do you find priests are struggling with most commonly? Without breaking any confidentiality, I mean, or naming names or anything like that.
I guess I would say that there are different kind of categories I would put this problems in. Like occasionally, like you mentioned treatment center. So occasionally I'm working with somebody that's coming back from a treatment center. So maybe that had to do with some kind of substance abuse issue or some kind of relationship boundary violation. And, you know, they're kind of reintegrating, if you will, and the bishop is trying to decide where to place them and that kind of thing. So I have situations like that, but I also have situations of just good holy priests who are just struggling with issues of anxiety, you know, all the same issues that anybody struggles with in our society, you know, maybe issues of time management, even anxiety, how to setting good boundaries, all these kind of, and some of them may have issues like they're a little more, you know, have obsessive compulsive issues or prone to depression or those kinds of things as well. So I see a lot of, I guess, what everyone struggles with, but they're struggling with it in a particular context, you know, in their ministry. And so that's the overlap point that, that I try to help with.
I agree. I think the same things that anybody would deal with. I mean, priests are people too. And so if we're human beings, we're going to struggle with all those human things. I think the added layer is that as we struggle with them, there's a consequence in some ways for us, that our thinking as priests is that if this doesn't go well, or if I say the wrong thing, then I have just led somebody away from the church, or I have kept them from God. And if I've kept them from God, then I've endangered their immortal soul. And so we have this like added weight that's attached that we've really got to think about. And sometimes I don't think we understand how to do those things that will help us to, or help another person, or to repair those things that are broken, those relational places, you know?
So let me throw this out. What you're just describing could be the same thing that maybe a codependent wife feels, like she has to take responsibility for her husband, a husband or a single guy or whatever, feeling like he's responsible for other people, and so or he has to do enough work to earn something, you know, or he's not good enough or something like that. So if a priest feels like he's responsible for everybody's souls, like obviously, he does have that shepherding responsibility. Right. So I'm not denying that, but I'm just saying, like, on some level, it's still not in his control. It is ultimately in God's hands. And so to be able to accept that and realize all I can do is my very best. All I can do is offer myself. And if I am living in anxiety and worry that I'm, you know, am I harming somebody? Am I doing enough? Am I not doing enough? Then that is not actually helping. That actually is something that needs to, you know, dare I say, be renounced or be you know, turned over, because and almost surrendered.
Okay, so right there, you're using some important language, like renounced, surrendered, something that we can entrust to God. Mm-hmm. I don't know that we often, when we're thinking about therapy, think in terms of renouncing something or surrendering a lie that we've held on to. We think more in terms of going back and doing some healing work. So I'm really intrigued by another piece of your book, which is your integration of internal family systems therapy. First, can you give us a little snapshot of what internal family systems therapy is? And then we'll get into how it integrates with the Catholic faith and spirituality.
Yeah, so internal family systems is a parts work approach. So it's basically the idea that within our interior world, we're not just one thing. We're not just one personality with no depth or complexity. That in fact, there's a multiplicity within. And so we have parts. That's how the term that's used. Sometimes we could say an aspect of self or subpersonality or something. But we have different parts that are kind of take on roles, right? So I have a part of me that takes on the role of therapist, perhaps a part of me that takes on the role of dad, a part of me that takes on the role of friend or husband. And so those roles are, are useful and helpful, generally speaking. But to speak, to connect it too with what we were just saying about renouncing and surrendering, though our parts can carry burdens. Mm. Right. And so some of our parts that are sort of managerial or helpful or resourceful, like I was mentioning, the worker and the father and this kind of thing, they may be carrying burdens of I'm not good enough, or I have to perform, I have to do more in order to be acceptable or loved, or these kinds of things. But we also have parts that are, we call them exiles, parts that are maybe pushed further into, maybe I would say, the unconscious mind, that they're pushed further away because they are carrying really heavy burdens of wounds from the past. They're carrying deep levels of shame or deep or extreme fear. And so the system naturally pushes them away. And we, our system is kind of organized, gets organized around making sure that those exiles don't interfere, don't overwhelm the system. Right. And then we have other parts in internal family systems, they call them firefighters, but we have other parts that are going to be a backup kind of system to make sure that those exiles with shame and fear and so on don't interfere. And sometimes those parts can be extreme roles. Right. That's where you get into perhaps substance abuse or you get into extreme forms of reactivity or anger or this kind of thing in order to numb out or to bypass or to short circuit those really negative, painful feelings. Right. And so then those firefighters, so we have parts that are really, hell-bent to make sure that the system doesn't get overwhelmed. But the manager parts also resent the consequences that come with the firefighters being so reactive or being, because there's obviously going to be consequences if you numb out with alcohol or numb out with video games or anything like this. And so basically what I'm hopefully painting this picture is that our inner world is actually kind of complex and there's a lot of moving pieces and there's sometimes conflicts even within. And so this whole approach of parts work is about bringing harmony to the system, which involves unburdening these parts. It involves, but before that, getting to know these parts and getting a relationship with our own interior parts. That's my quick, I could keep going, but I'll stop there.
No, that's good.
The idea of jumping into relationship with parts is something that, so I like, not without getting way too personal for public radio. When I was reading the book, I was like, oh, one of these parts is 12-year-old Matt, And so I found myself essentially talking to 12-year-old me. And on one level I was like, this feels pretty weird. I don't know if I'm supposed to be doing this, but I don't know, but I went for it, in good faith. And I thought it was somewhat effective, mm-hmm. And so I guess the question is are the parts pieces of you that have a stunted growth because of a wound? Is that a good way to define, or a wounded part at least?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, in a manner of speaking, I would say some parts are stuck in certain developmental kind of stages. Mm. So I love it that you're speaking to your, what was it? Did you say 12 or 11 year old self?
Yeah. I mean, I just threw the number 12 out there. Yeah, yeah. Now, but, yeah.
So I love it that you're speaking to your 12 year old part. And I think that I wish people would do that and connect with those parts, because 12 year old you, whatever it was that you experienced, sort of stays stuck at that stage of development. And even when you connect with it, you kind of need to connect with it as if you're talking to a 12-year-old. And, you know, because it is sort of there. And once you do and you figure out, oh, okay, what did that 12-year-old kind of need? You needed it way back when all of you was 12, but this part of you is still present. Yes. And so what can you give that part now that he always needed? And when you do that, and that might involve some unburdening or whatever right. needs to happen, it frees up that 12-year-old to grow. It frees up that 12-year-old part to actually take a place in your system. You could enjoy 12-year-old Matt. 12-year-old Matt is probably a cool little kid in his own way and probably has some joy and fun and playfulness. And hey, wouldn't that be great to have more active in your system?
Right, right. Is it, and this might be a silly question, right? Let's say that 12-year-old Matt gets healed, right? Does 12-year-old Matt take 5 years to become 26-year-old Matt, you know? Or is it like, you know, even though that was obviously the incorrect math, but you know what I mean? Like, is it right. progressive where 12-year-old Matt is suddenly 16-year-old Matt?
Right.
And now I got to tell him to shut up because he was being
You know, that's such a great question. And I can't honestly say that I have the answer for that perfectly.
Okay.
And one of the reasons is I don't think it's the same for everybody.
Right.
So in other words, I think that there might be a place for a 12-year-old Matt in your system who will stay 12.
Ooh.
But if he's unburdened, he's just he's part of that diversity of your system.
Right.
And that's a little bit the way I tend to look at it, but I'm not opposed to the idea that that part may also develop in ways that we don't expect. And
right.
so the approach that I would simply take with that is to check in with those parts.
Mm.
You know, how is this part? Is this part still 12? Does this part look the same to you
right,
when you
right.
check in with it? Or is it changed? And I feel like there's such a beauty to our inner world that we just sort of respect it by just finding out, like looking inside and finding out.
Right.
And maybe 12-year-old Matt has advanced in some way, or advanced in
right.
age, if you will.
Right.
And maybe not. And either way, I'm not sure it's good or bad one way or another necessarily.
Right. And I guess in the analogy, I was thinking of the growth in age as the growth in maturity. But the thing is like, if the 12-year-old version of me is known for it is like defined by his playfulness, you know, getting older doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, you like cease being playful, right? Is the point, you know? So like it could just be a more mature kind of playfulness that doesn't have to be, you know, corroborated by age.
Yeah. Yeah. And I will throw this out if I could get just slightly personal. Like there's a 5-year-old Jerry. I know there's a middle school year old Jerry and a high school year old Jerry that I've worked with in my own work.
Right.
And I don't see those parts as aging myself. Mm. And I actually enjoy those parts at the ages they're at. And
sure.
And when I see my 5-year-old self now and he's so beautiful and so full of love and energy and innocence, that I kind of think that when Christ says, let the children come to me, that he's speaking to my 5-year-old part.
Mm. Mm.
So, you know, I don't really need him or want him to change. If he does, he does. I mean, maybe, you know.
Yeah, I love that because it's kind of like, you know, when you, again, I'm going to try and draw an analogy, but when you look on art, you know, like art is beautiful, or at least good art is beautiful, right? And you want to just like, look at it and take it in for what it is. And if indeed our inner system is complex and beautiful, like you say, why would we try and change it? You know, unless there's something that's gone awry. And so, okay, maybe it's lacking beauty here, or it's lacking truth or goodness here. But once it's in the system and it's all aligned, why would we mess with it? Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And you know what's interesting too is when you work with people and you encounter various parts, sometimes those parts show up in very different and unexpected ways. So sometimes you see a part shows up like So something even non-human like a dragon or a wall or a, you know, something like this, or even a something that doesn't look like it should be, right? Like maybe, you know, I've seen this sometimes with women, like a part that's like a prostitute, or even though she's not a prostitute, right?
Right, right.
Or,
yeah.
Or like some part that just doesn't. And what you do when you work with that part, and you just try to understand that part, and you try to connect with that part, you try to understand what's going on. And what will sometimes happen in a session is that part will then shift and reveal itself, that it's not actually a wall, it's not a dragon or a prostitute, that it's possibly a little boy or a little girl or some other part. And that's how it's showing itself as a way to protect itself in that moment. Mm. And so you're kind of uncovering the truth of what's there.
Yeah. Now, Matt, I think you recently had an experience like this. Right before we started recording, you were telling me a great story about waking up from anesthesia. And what did you have to say? Because I think this could be something. Let's tell that story here, because I think there could be something there.
That's it. Yeah. Are you cool with just doing therapy on the air, Dr.
Real quick, no. It doesn't count as
therapy.
We'll
get you to sign something.
I had an endoscopy, and so I was under anesthesia. I'm in light anesthesia, but... And when I woke up, my wife was there because the doctor, you know, had said, like, is your ride here? Yeah, she's here. You want me to bring her back? To which I was like, absolutely. I'm going to forget what you say anyway, let alone whether or not I have anesthesia.
So you would have forgotten no matter what. It's not about the medication, right?
I would have forgotten no matter what. But so she was there, and the nurse was like, okay, you know, you just woke up. You can sit up now. To which I responded, all right, one, two, in the words of Deadpool, maximum effort, three, and then pulled myself up. And my wife is standing next to me like, what? Deadpool?
So Matt has a Deadpool part, so and I'm wondering what that is and what that means. Like, let's examine that.
Well, let me just say to start with, like, I'm an incredible geek, so I could go into all of your parts that are various characters from Marvel and DC.
Fantastic. I'm open to this.
Yeah. So you have, obviously, there is a part of you that's irreverent, right?
And,
who does have a heart of gold. If you do know the character, he isn't actually a bad guy.
Right.
So
anyway, but that was, nice little tangent there.
I love it. Oh, man.
I didn't know I liked that character that much to be the first thing I quote after anesthesia. So
that's right.
When you talk about unburdening these parts, I think it's an important word. And maybe there's a correlation there with some of the spiritual language that we use of surrender or renouncing. If you look at some of the work done by like Dr. Bob Schutz at the JP2 Healing Center, they talk a lot about renouncing lies and affirming the truth. So you renounce the lie that I am unlovable, that I am disgusting, that God is mad at me, and for the sake of inviting God's healing presence and power into your life. So the unburdening, that's language that comes straight out of the internal family systems therapy books, right? Straight from Schwartz. Mm-hmm. But in your book, you're doing some interesting things too with kind of bringing this therapeutic system and theory into relationship with the Catholic faith, because of course it's not a Catholic, it's not in any way explicitly a Catholic model. If anything, it's agnostic. So can you talk a little bit about how you bring internal family systems therapy into the context of the Catholic faith and spirituality?
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that. I would even argue, I mean, I think when internal family systems came out and Dick Schwartz in the 80s sort of developed this model, and in some of the textbooks and so on that were coming out in the 1990s, I think you could describe it as an agnostic model at that time. I don't think it currently is.
Okay.
I think that it is really a model currently that is entrenched in a Eastern religious perspective, whether that's Buddhism or Hinduism or transcendental meditation or something, but it's strongly influenced by that at this moment in time. And so that's one of the reasons why I say I do parts work, for a few reasons. One is, yes, I'm an internal family systems informed therapist, but I've done a lot of training in ego state therapy, which is actually a parts work approach that predates IFS. So it wasn't invented in the 1980s or 90s. It's actually been around for a long time. I kind of go to some pain to kind of explore that in the appendices. I realize not everybody cares, but I put that in the appendices as a timeline and everything to understand that Parts Work predates IFS. And Schwartz has really moved into a lot of spiritual spaces that make me very uncomfortable. And it's why I've kind of like moved into my own space, just sort of pushing for a Christian Parts Work kind of accompaniment model. And I'm planning to do training, you know, training therapists and spiritual directors and coaches on this model. But what I care about here is just, yeah, the integration of the Catholic faith, because in one of Schwartz's recent books, No Bad Parts, he really describes the self as this sort of field, like the force, right? Kind of like the force in Star Wars that is all over. And we have a little bit of that larger world self, capital letters self. And we have a little bit of that within us. So we're a little drop of the ocean self in this bigger self, which he won't say is God, but it could be God in his way of thinking. Yeah. And so, which really is, right? I see the light go on there. It really is like pantheism or panentheism or something. Right. And so it doesn't make the distinction between creator and creature. And all of a sudden, there's this sort of shift, and Schwartz starts talking about, you know, there's a self for every country, or there's a self for the globe, or Mother Earth is like a self. Mm-hmm. And there's this whole thing. And so, and that's, if that's where they want to go, that is fine, but it isn't Catholic. And so part of one of the other reasons I wrote this book was to actually provide a Catholic version of Parts Work. Yes. And I didn't just want to baptize IFS or ego state therapy or anything like that so much as to reveal that it's a multiplicity, an understanding of the multiplicity of the inner person, and an understanding of the innermost self. The inmost self is actually part of the fabric of our faith. It isn't just an auxiliary. Maybe the Bible or the church fathers or whatnot weren't using the language exactly the way that Schwartz did, of course. Right. They're not. But when you look at it...
Well, he is a pantheist, so...
Right, right. But when you look at it, you know, it actually is there. It's in St. Paul. It's in, I would say it's in the Old Testament. It's in our understanding of the heart, the innermost heart. Innermost, in St. Paul is saying the inmost self. And even St. James talking about a war within my members, things like that. So or St. Augustine talking about my disintegrated heart. So it's just all over the place when you have eyes to see it in our history. So that's what I really wanted to bring out. I really wanted that to be revealed.
Yeah, I mean, it's also just so experiential, right? Like, what is it? St. Paul says, I do the things I don't want to do, right? Exactly. And so it's like, who here hasn't experienced that?
Yeah.
You know? Right.
And what I also love about whether it's IFS, ego state therapy, this whole parts work approach, is that it isn't just a cognitive experience. A lot of traditional therapy, like the most popular, is probably CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, and it's good, right? It's good stuff, but it's a lot of talk therapy, and it's a lot of, you know, using that left side of the brain to basically work through issues. And you will get there eventually, I think, for most of us, but what this model does is it's actually experiential. If you're doing therapy with somebody that's using this model, you're actually doing the work of being guided through working with those parts and connecting with that inmost self and doing that healing work in session. So you literally, it's not like you have to go home and apply. Well, you do have to put it into practice, but you're actually having that experience of healing in the session. Not just talking about what healing would look like or what would be, you know, how nice it would be if I didn't have these false beliefs or this negative thinking and applying the, you know, the truth to it or whatever. That's all good. But what about actually having it happen in the session? Which I just, for me as a therapist, like, that's so powerful and beautiful to observe.
Yeah. Right. It's amazing seeing how in using the parts work, just by giving that little cue to somebody, like, to, if they acknowledge this part, an exile part, and that exile is a six-year-old that's afraid, a six-year-old that's feeling very hurt, and a six-year-old that's ashamed. So you kind of say, all right, as you acknowledge what that six-year-old is feeling, then how do you speak to that six-year-old? What do you think that six-year-old needs to hear? And so there's an opportunity for some sort of right in the moment, like Matt, you were saying before about talking to the 12-year-old, right? Talking to that 12-year-old version of you. But yeah, how powerful that can be for somebody in the moment to actually have that conversation with somebody, a therapist, who can actually accompany them and give them some guidance
right.
for it, so that they can then process through in as it's happening right away. And then they walk out with a sense of deep healing and comfort. Like that six-year-old has been consoled. That six-year-old has been told that it's okay and that they're understood. And so they walk out not feeling burdened, but feeling more truly who they really are. So one of the things you do is you talk about the inmost self. You adopt the language of St. Paul, so as not to use the language of sort of the global self that is part of the force and everything else.
Can I say something though to what you just said, just real quick? Because I liked what you said very much. But I would just only add that it's not only that you talk to that six-year-old, let's say, and that it feels better for hearing what it needs to hear, like you're lovable or something, and then it feels better. It's actually even more than that. Yeah. That it actually is, if that part needed to be held, or that part needed to belong, needed a mom or a dad, or it needed that, you're actually providing that experience in vivo. So it's actually, and that might typically, in the work I do, it would be like our adult now self or innermost self would provide that for that part. Mm. But it also, the self is capable of doing a few other things. Could bring in other parts of the system to help support that process. Mm. Could bring in spiritual resources as well. So it could bring in the Holy Family. It could, if for whatever reason, you know, a mom or dad, there's lots of reasons why that might not work. But our Lord provides whatever we might need. So whether it's Our Lady or whether it's Saint Joseph as the perfect parents or some other saint or angel, but we can bring in whatever spiritual resources, inner resources to bear, and so that the six-year-old actually has an experience, perhaps, of being loved and has an experience of being brought into the system in a loving, caring, belonging way, and so now has an actual part.
Yeah.
So it's more than even words, I would add, is just wanted to throw out there.
That's awesome.
I think, I'm gonna add, as the non-clinical psychologist, I'm going to throw something in here, too. It seems to me like the therapist in this scenario is an extension of Christ as the good shepherd, in that, you know, he's helping pastor the person, and also an extension of Christ as the divine physician, in that he's helping to heal the person. And frankly, now this one's less thought through, it's coming out on the fly, so hopefully it's good.
I like that.
I think that you may like it, Father Sam, but I think that it's also really powerful to the idea of, you know, well, Mary, you know, can God gives us what we need, and so Mary might be made present, or Saint Joseph might be made present, or the Lord Himself, right, or an angel, or whatever. But Christ is present with us in our suffering, and so if it's a situation where you're the 12-year-old, or you're the 16-year-old, or you're the 5-year-old, and there's suffering there. You know, it could be like Mary's under the cross with you there, you know? So I see like a deep spiritual well in your description of this particular process that I feel a great affinity towards. So,
No, I love that. I'm sitting with here, what you just said though, is the therapist is an extension of the Good Shepherd, and that would be wonderful. However, might, you know, and I'm processing it while you're saying it, so it might change my mind.
But just tell me I'm wrong. It's okay.
Well, I don't know that I want to say wrong. I think that I would say I might reposition that a little, because here's how I see it. I see it as Christ, as the Good Shepherd, for sure, and however the other many ways Christ can be, as providing grace to the person's inmost self.
Yes.
And the inmost self is sort of that mediator, that faculty, the deepest center, spiritual center of the heart, that can then extend that grace to all the parts.
Yes.
So the role of the therapist, I would say, is not necessarily good shepherd, although, I mean, just as a baptized Christian, maybe I can,
right,
on
sure.
some level, express that, but is more, I would love to see it as apostle, that it would be more like a supporter of the process of helping that person connect with their inmost self and connect with, obviously, that grace, and then connect with their parts. So I see it as, you know, an Apostle Peter or Apostle Andrew
right.
or somebody supporting the process is all.
Right.
Not to glorify, yeah, I'd love to be the good shepherd, like just put me in that role. No, I don't want that. That's too much.
A less than perfect, but still somewhat good shepherd.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's really good. That's really good.
But I love, Matt, what you were saying. Like, the way I see it is our inner landscape is so available to us in terms of setting up a situation that we need. And when those graces are flowing, you know, into the inmost self through all of our faculties, whether it's our faculties of imagination or obviously our will, our intellect, but it's flowing through that. It provides the opportunity for whatever we need to be available. So even if it's, you know, if it's Saint Joseph protecting me from a demon,
right,
you know, is the, you know, and I never had that protection from my own father as a child, but Saint Joseph is doing that. I wouldn't say, like, I'm not going so far as to say, you know, Saint Joseph is having some kind of vision within me, or I'm not trying to manipulate Saint Joseph as a saintly person, but I feel like the grace and inspiration to have that experience is coming through Christ, through my heart, into that moment. And anything's possible in that space then.
Right. That kind of begs an interesting question, which is like, how do you define these experiences, right? Because it's like when we're talking about parts, we're not talking about metaphysical parts, right? Because, or at least like we have one soul is my point, you know?
Right.
And so how do we even approach this in that, like, you know, 12-year-old Matt isn't different than me.
Right.
You know, he's a part of me, but he's not a separate being from me. Right?
Yeah, so he has no ontological existence of his own.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, he's,
that's
yeah.
what I was trying to say the whole time.
No, it's good. It's a really great question. And deep, and I had to answer those questions, and I tended to put them in the footnotes because not everybody asks those really deep questions, but it's a good one.
I am so deep, Dr. I'm so deep.
But yeah, I mean, the way I see it is the self, our inmost self, is our spiritual center, and all the parts make up our heart, is how I've come to see it, our whole heart. And so you might say our personality, I don't know, you might say our mind, but I like the Greek word nous. I think it encompasses the idea of obviously intellect and mind, but also speaks to something more than that. It also speaks to the heart. And so I would say that all of those parts together is a one. Right, so we're one, and yet there's a diversity within that oneness. So similar, I mean, that's true of the Trinity in a sense as well, although it's not a perfect analogy. But in any case, but the parts themselves on a phenomenological level appear or sort of feel like they're a separate existence, like a separate ontological being, but they're not. But they at least on some phenomenological level feel that way because they sort of have their own feelings and thoughts and perspectives, and they're holding on to their own version of the memory that might be different from other parts of the system. So it really has this feeling of like as if you're talking to a little person that's different, but in a metaphysical sense, no, they aren't their own little beings. They aren't little people.
I'm filled with little beings. No,
and it's another way where I diverge from what I understand Schwartz has been saying of late. Like he goes into places where he starts to say parts have their own self, and then the parts will have parts, and I just feel like
infinite regression of parts.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's not necessary, and I don't see it that way, and it just sort of muddies the metaphysical waters way too much.
Right. It probably makes healing a lot harder too. You know what I mean? If you have to keep digging for parts.
Right.
My gosh.
Yeah. Keep it simple.
Yeah.
Keep it simple.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Matt, I'm glad you used that phrase, though, digging for parts. Like, constantly trying to uncover something. And I think there's almost maybe there's a hesitation from some folks to look into things like therapy or, frankly, even the idea of spiritual healing. There's a sense sometimes from people that
I don't want to have to dig that up. It's the past. I've moved on. I'm okay. I don't want to have to go and look at that because I've taken care of it. And they might really need to actually examine it. Or there's the thought mm-hmm. that, no, I'm fine. I've never had a wound. I've never been hurt. I'm okay. There's nothing traumatic in my life, because their thinking of trauma is that trauma has to be something really, really big, really terrible, really awful, right. really life altering. And so there can be a resistance to that sort of uncovering. Or there's the fear that I'm going to dig up something that's not real. I'm going to create in my own head through this process. I'm going to invent something and it's false. And then I'm lying about it just so that I can sound like I need healing or something. So, Dr. Jerry, how would you approach that with somebody where you're finding that kind of resistance?
Yeah, yeah. So in that last one is so interesting. I would be asking myself, if you have to create a trauma for yourself in order, what's the reason? So why is the part feel the need to create a trauma story that you don't have for some reason? Mm. So I'd be curious, first of all, just curious about that. Because I think that our minds don't typically do that unless there's a motive for it.
Right.
And the motive could be like, I don't want to look at the actual trauma I have.
Right.
Because then that would unearth things that I have put away that my system doesn't want to deal with. So we don't. I think it's a very human response not to want to approach these exiles because they've been exiled for a reason. they overwhelm the system at one time. Yeah. And it doesn't matter if you were four and Jimmy, your art partner, poured, you know, all the red paint on your head and everybody laughed at you in class and you should be over that by now. That might, for a four-year-old, that would have been the end of the world, right? That right. moment. And so, and the system might have put that little memory and that experience very far away. And as an adult, we might go, oh yeah, well, you know, you can get over that, whatever. But no, that was traumatic. That was overwhelming. It may not have been a plane crash or a war zone, but for that part, it really was, or that person at that time was overwhelming. So we have a tendency to have lots of resistance because our parts don't want to go there. And so as a therapist, and maybe even kind of even where our conversation is gone, we naturally want to go to those wounded parts because I think we're just good people and we care about the wounded, exiled, hurting parts and want to heal them. But you actually don't start there at all. You actually start by figuring out what are the parts that are protecting the system. Because until they're on board, until they have agreed, they're not going to let us get close to the exiles. And if we somehow bypass them, they're going to be really angry and there's going to be a backlash. So why would we do that? We actually want to work with the protectors because they actually end up being our best friends. They end up being huge resources in healing. But they will come with all sorts of resistance. Like, this is stupid. I don't need this. I'm here as a protector for a good reason. Why would we even look at the past? What's the point of all that? Can't we just move forward? Like, all those excuses.
Yeah.
But it's all of it is a way to protect the system from those earlier pains.
Mm. So kind of digging, we're just saying we don't want to dig things up, but like asking those questions, kind of questioning that part that's saying, oh, I don't want to do this. Why do you want to protect that? What is it that's there that you're trying to protect? Wow, that's...
Yeah, you work with that part and hear its story and understand what... Like, a good question for a part that's a protector, if you are, you know, if you're just doing this with the book or whatever, and I think it's in there, but is to simply ask, what are you afraid of will happen if you stop protecting in this way? What are you afraid would happen? Because then you get to the motive. And then as soon as you understand the motive, you can understand the part. Like, even if the part is like... binge drinking every weekend. Well, what are you afraid of will happen if you stop binge drinking?
Yeah.
I'll have to be alone with my isolation, or I'll have to face the fact that I abandoned my child, or I might have to face the fact that I lost this person I care about. Well, that makes sense then, right? Like, I don't agree. I don't maybe like the way that the part has learned to cope, but it certainly changes our understanding of why this part is doing what it's doing. And then we have something to work with then.
Wow. Yeah. So as a Catholic therapist, do you find challenges in offering therapy in an explicitly Catholic context? And what advice would you give to other Catholics who are in the therapeutic field?
I love working in a Catholic context, so it's my favorite context to work in. And because I just feel like, you know, we're a body soul composite. We have a spirituality, we have a physical body. So we include somatic or body based treatments as well as mental, like mind oriented, as well as spiritual. So why not work with the whole person? I feel like that is just what we, you know, essential. So the fact that I can work with people and their faith, and I work, you know, Catholics, but even non-Catholic Christians in the Christian faith. I mean, I'll work with non-Catholics too. It's just I won't have those resources. But it's not even my resources specifically, it's theirs. Mm. So they're coming with their own faith experience and their strengths and their spiritual strengths and resources that I just want to tap into as part of the therapy. And so I just feel blessed beyond belief to be able to do that. And to other therapists, so if you're Catholic but you're not, you know, maybe practicing that way, like there are a lot of ways which you can practice in a Catholic way without being terribly explicit. I just consider even the exercise of being a therapist and being in a space with somebody is sort of sacramental, at least when you invite Christ, you invite the Holy Spirit to be kind of with you. Yeah. So just even that. But there's also more and more, you know, there's trainings. I'm planning to offer some trainings in this. There's the Catholic Psychotherapy Association, which is a group of growing Catholic therapists who are learning to integrate their faith and community with each other and stuff like that. So there's support more and more. Like there's practices like mine. There's some all over the place that are group practices of Catholics coming together and doing this kind of therapy together. So, well, and you know Dr. Greg already and what he does. And so this is happening all over because I think there's just a great need for it.
Are you seeing then maybe like a movement? Some instigation of the Holy Spirit to just kind of call this out at a time when it's desperately needed, that these Catholic therapists are stepping up. And I mean, almost at the level of like vocationally saying, this is what God has asked me to do. And this is how he's asking me to serve in the church.
I see it that way. I see it as a part of the new evangelization, because I think why are we, for people to just go to church and all right, just, are you forced to go to church or you feel duty bound and you're just going to church and leave? Like, shouldn't the church be a place of actual healing of mind, body, and spirit? Like, shouldn't the church be, isn't this something we can offer the church that's tangible? And there aren't enough priests to do it, and they're not always trained in the psychological sciences necessarily, but we should be doing it with them, alongside with them, and offering something to the church. And I think it's a real something that if people experience, it's going to change their lives. It's going to change their relationships with God. Mm. That's what I was hoping my book would do, would help bring people closer to Christ. So I have a very evangelical purpose to the whole exercise. Awesome. Yeah. Yeah.
So besides...
You've heard it here first, folks. Yeah.
This is a question I used to ask our guests like when we first started this show, and I haven't asked anybody this in ages. Besides telling them, hey, you should buy the book Litanies of the Heart and read it and use it for yourself and then start to apply the principles for others. But what advice would you give to priests for accompanying people and for finding healing themselves?
That's a big question.
It's a big, So you've got 30 seconds, go.
Well, I mean, I honestly think, I mean, and I don't know that I'm going to say anything profound that probably maybe priests haven't heard a lot. I don't know. But I just think it is leaning in and continually rediscovering the amazing beauty of your vocation and the fact that you are called and to be set apart. And that you are called, you know, obviously to be a shepherd, but you are called to bring people to a place of transcendence. And I think we need transcendence more than anything. Yes, we need to have that deep sense of Christ's closeness, but I think there's no question, but I think our world is in need of sacred spaces. And I think even young people, I don't know, Matt, what you would agree with me, but it's so secularized. It's so technologically like everywhere, like, you know, where I see here young people saying, you know, I would just as well, you know, be hooked up to the Matrix and, you know, live a virtual life than an embodied one. And, and so I'm saying, I think there's a hunger for young people to actually have that sense of the sacred and to be transported, if you will, into this sort of a mystical or this sort of world of, enchantment, because it's like your spirit is being raised to heights. And to see, like, I go to Byzantine Catholic Church, so I go to Divine Liturgy, and I feel like in that liturgy, I am being transported into heaven. But I think that's true, of course, of every Mass. And and I think that for priests to own that space, that that's their role, to bring people into communion with heaven, there's no greater vocation. That's just so beautiful. So own that. Own that. Don't try to come down to the earth in the sense of being secularized or just trying to meet them always. Yes, you meet people where they are at, but but lift them. And that... I just think that's amazing. So that's my advice.
That's awesome. I love it. That's
your priesthood will be successful now.
But it's so true, especially what you're saying about recognizing how we can elevate and we have a role to play in elevating people to Christ and helping them to get there. You know, Christ comes to us, right? He lowers himself to raise us up. But we can't stay here. Like, we can't insist that, no, this is the place. This is the plane on which we all have to remain. Otherwise, we're getting in the way of Christ elevating us and raising us up. Right?
And honestly, can I throw out something else that's just hitting me? And I'm seeing you have just such a wonderful demeanor, and I feel like you're I'm sure you do this, but when you encounter a priest who embodies a loving spirit, a joyful and loving spirit, it's as though you're encountering Christ. And I think that I hopefully can do that as a therapist, and Matt, you can too, and everybody, but there's nothing like feeling like this person is truly a father and they care for you. There's just something healing in that presence. And I think some priests have forgotten that. And that's, so I'll throw that extra bit.
Yeah. No, thank you for saying that. I appreciate it. Not just because you said nice things about me, but also more importantly, I think you're right on. Priests forget that. But then this comes into your work too. And I think the reason why priests themselves ought to seek out any kind of healing ministry therapy or mentorship, this kind of stuff that can really assist them on the way, because I think the reason that many priests have forgotten what it is to have that demeanor, what it is to have that Christ-like approach, what it is to be a father, is because of the wounds that they themselves carry in their relationships, whether it's with their own father, with their bishop, with even the very people that they serve. You know, and when we forget our identity, or when we ourselves are carrying those wounds, it's hard to see the truth of who we are, that we're called to be fathers, we're called to be spiritual fathers, we're called to elevate people and bring them to Christ. And so when that healing can take place, it revitalizes priesthood in such a powerful way.
Yeah, because you're leaning into your identity and your purpose and your calling, and it's what's so deeply meaningful. And I would, as you're saying that, I'm thinking, and you mentioned bishops, I'm like, bishops need to hear that advice more than anybody, I think, because they've got so many administrative responsibilities. It's so overwhelming for so many of them, but they forget, perhaps they forget, or they don't know how, or they never got it, or something like that. But they, just their presence and their fatherly presence is so powerful to their priests, as well as to all the people. Like, it is so meaningful. And I've heard that, I've seen situations where priests have felt disconnected from their bishops, like they weren't loved or cared for. And maybe the bishop doesn't realize they have to take care of the, like, they're all grown-ups or something, but they're not. On some level, they're little children that also need their daddy too. Yeah. And they look to the bishop that way. And it's just a lot of pressure, obviously, on the poor bishop. But if he owns that role, I mean, I think he's going to see that the priests will love him for it and will be given energy and motivation through that.
Yeah. A priest might be called to be a father, but he still needs to be fathered, right? He still needs somebody who's a father for him. And I think the same goes for bishops. You're absolutely right. I think the things that they face, if diocesan priests are dealing with things that they had zero training for and that isn't really part of what the vocation to the priesthood really is or what they plan for it to be, I think even more so that applies to bishops. Because the things that are now on a bishop's plate, the things that they now have to take care of, are so far beyond what the office is really about. So we've got to be able to start finding that healthier balance so that bishops can be the shepherds and the fathers that they're supposed to be, so that priests can be the shepherds and fathers that they're supposed to be, but also then so that the whole church can really breathe and function the way mm-hmm. that it's meant to.
Yeah. 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 And one thing I think would be lovely, right, in back in the earlier church, like they typically grabbed bishops a lot of the time out of monasteries and like kind of forced them to take on the role. And so you're talking about somebody that was being identified and chosen because of their perceived holiness. And so that's an interesting fact. But also to counterbalance that, like I remember someone once telling me, like St. Augustine of Hippo, like he was a bishop, his whole diocese wasn't larger than some large parishes out here, you know, in a large city. So, you know, imagine being a bishop of just, you know, 1,000 people or something. Like it would change the game versus what right. our poor bishops have, which is you know, hundreds of thousands of people in some, you know, in many cases where they're supposedly able to shepherd. How on earth could you be that for your people, let alone your priests? Like right. if you're overwhelmed in that way. So they just need our prayers. Obviously they need our support because it's a very daunting task all around for everybody.
Yeah.
Man, that's a tangent. Sorry. There's a tangent.
But you're absolutely, it's so true. I mean, we could talk for hours about governance in the church and the way that we need to bring healing. And we could bring up, there was the survey a couple years ago that talks about priests and their bishops and that relationship and the brokenness that's there. I mean, there's so much, you're absolutely right. There's so much there, but if we can end the tangent and come, just bring it back right here to this. And I know, we've taken up a lot of your time, but this litanies of the heart, real quick, can you just tell us what your three litanies
are? So there's the wounded heart, the closed heart, and the fearful heart. And each one is based on a different attachment style. Although I think we all, even though we typically have one predominant attachment style that we might have, we experience all of them. And so at different times, we're going to need a different litany. But the wounded heart is designed for that person who is feeling anxious in the world, who's been hurt and is responding with anxiety. The closed heart is for that person who is withdrawn, right? Who avoids, who's numbing out their feelings, this kind of thing. So sometimes we feel closed and sometimes we just feel wounded. And the fearful heart is kind of a person who's kind of going between the two, possibly in a way, like wanting to connect, but then wanting with withdrawal, being afraid to connect, and yet, but then pulling back and this kind of thing. So each one is designed to take you from wherever you're at, wherever you start at, into connection with Christ.
Yeah. Now, if we look at the idea of either like a country having a psychology or an institution having a personality or something, and then we try to apply parts to that, I'm thinking of these particular litanies and I'm seeing, wow, we could say that about the church. The church has a part that's wounded. The church has a part that's closed. The church has a part that's fearful. And so often that influences how the church operates and how we, like, as church, big picture, do things or how we take things on. But then, again, if the church is made up of many members, all of us, then each of us, we have the wounded part. We have the closed part. We have the... right. The fearful part.
Well, I love that. You just got me thinking. So if the inmost self of the church has to be Christ, he's the head of the church. So if he's eclipsed by anxious parts, so, you know, leaders who are overwhelmed by administrivia or leaders overwhelmed by scandal or leaders or other parts also like that, that are struggling in all sorts of ways. And those parts of the church are overwhelmed and they're eclipsing essentially Christ, the church is not healthy. And we need to, you know, we need to allow Christ to heal those parts of the church and to heal all of us, right? In order for the church to do its job of outreach. And I think that's the same with the individual person. So if my inmost self is not active, so if my part dysregulated and burdened parts are the ones running the show all the time, then I'm not accessing my inmost self. I'm not much good to other people. But when there's harmony in my inner system and my innermost self is the one leading, it's the one that's guiding, it's the one that's active, and Christ and his graces are working through that, then, and I'm in that place of inner harmony, then I am going to be a way loving, more loving person to others. I'm going to be able to change lives. I'm going to be able to do things. Ultimately, I'll be able to connect with others, but also connect with God. Like I can't even connect with God if I'm in this disintegrated space within. So, So yeah. I think it all, it's cool. I like the different layers. It's very St. Maximus, the confessor of the microcosm, the inner person, and then the larger church.
I wasn't expecting Maximus the Confessor to come up today.
We could have a whole episode on that if you want to. I love him.
Oh, man. Wow. He's so good. All right. Well.
Don't tempt us, Doc. Yeah.
Dr. Jerry Crete, you've been really generous with your time. Thank you so much for joining us on The Tangent. How can people find out about you? Where can they get the book?
They can get the book at Sophia Institute Press at their website, although I think it's in back order right now, actually, already. It's also awesome. On Amazon.
Nice.
And stuff.
Congratulations.
And, so you can get the book there. You can learn, if you want to learn about more about the integration of IFS and the Catholic faith, you can go to soulsandhearts.com. Tons of resources, podcasts, the interior integration for Catholics podcast, blogs and things on Souls and Hearts. And my practice is transfigurationcounseling.com, and we have counselors and coaches.
So good.
Awesome.
Well, great. We'll put all those links in the show notes so that everybody can find it. Dr. Jerry Crete, thank you so much. It's great to meet you. Great to have this conversation with you.
To be with you guys.
So you have things to say?
I have things to say. something that I really just wanted to get out in the interview, but I didn't think there was an appropriate time to say it, so I'm including it here. Was like a scripture verse came to me a little bit, and it was, "Be perfect like your heavenly Father is perfect," and how I think a lot of people hear that scripture verse and are like, "Oh my gosh, how on earth am I going to be perfect?" You know what I mean? Like, we have that, like, we have this reaction of like, you want me to never sin ever, you know?
Right.
And that, in a sense, that's kind of the negative view. But there's a positive view that I think kind of just, you know, Dr. Jerry enlightened for me a little bit, which is like being perfect isn't just not sinning, you know, it's growing in virtue, but it's also being healed, you know? And so, like, this litanies of the heart, you know, and this particular system of therapy that Dr. Jerry is an expert in and leads people through, right? Leads them to this like perfection of the inner life. Or at least like that's the bar, like that's the goal, you know, like, because of course it's the goal. We're not aiming for not perfection, you know, we're always trying to be perfect. And just how, I don't know, I was just moved by how the inner family systems approach that he uses can lead to that kind of healing, and how that's what God desires for us. And ultimately that healing comes from Christ through this system. So I don't know that if that makes any sense.
It absolutely does. If we're looking at how a person, look at the great saints and look at what they're seeking. The great saints are always seeking to grow in relationship with Christ. And if they're seeking to grow in relationship with Christ, then they're learning how to be who God made them to be, which means they're coming to a greater place of integration. So the gifts that God has given them are going to be used properly. The places in their lives that are broken, that need to be healed, will be healed. And it's all through that relationship with God. It's all through that relationship with Christ. It's all in the context of that. And so their different parts are becoming integrated. And as they become better integrated, they serve the church in a better way. If you look at the great saints and how they renew the church, what do? Well, they bring the church to what it's supposed to be. They help the church to really be what she is. I always say this, like, if you look at the bishop saints of the church, almost every time you see them, in their little bio, there's a little vignette about who they are, what they did. It's going to say something like, this bishop who became a saint, he reformed the clergy of his diocese.
That's
almost to a man.
One
of the tasks of, if there is a bishop who has saint in front of his name, you know, if you say Saint so-and-so bishop, almost to a man, it says that he reformed the clergy of his diocese. What is that? What that means is that he was helping his priests to be who they really are. And if he's helping his priests to be who they really are, then he's going to help the church to be who they really are. That's what John Paul II says, right? Be who you are. Become who you are.
That's, I was about to ask, which saint said that.
Yeah, that's John Paul II. Well, that's John Paul II, and that's his...
I was going to go St. Augustine, but that tells you a lot about St. John Paul II.
Yeah, well, because John Paul II is using his, like, the idea of personalism, that this is right. all about relationship. And, you know, when the evangelicals use the idea of, like, a personal relationship with Jesus, well, that makes perfect sense to us as Catholics because...
Right.
I mean... I don't want to take all the credit for it, but we kind of made that one up. We invented that. Jesus invented it, right? That's what he wants for each of us. He wants us to have a real personal relationship with him. He right. wants us to be in relationship. So if Jesus wants to be in relationship with us, then, man, all it takes is for us to embrace that idea and say, okay. Yeah, that's true. That's a reality. That's something that I can accept. That's something that I can say is true. And then we get into what it means. What does it mean to actually yeah. be in that relationship? And God starts doing the rest. It's so powerful. There's so much there.
Yeah. I would encourage anyone who's listening to this right now to stop and say a prayer inviting the Lord in. That's all I want to say. Like it's so key to pray.
Yeah.
So
all right. That was a long enough pause. Now we can keep going.
We weren't expecting you to actually pause the podcast. I mean, come on.
Oh, yeah, right, right. No, that's insane. Why, when they could listen to us, why would they ever hit pause so they could pay attention to God? Oh, my goodness. No, please listen to God more than you listen to us, but we're happy to be part of it. Anyway, links in the show notes. Please check it out. What Dr. Jerry Cree is doing is it's such good work. It's so important. And so we've got a whole bunch of things in there to really help, just to help you to find that place of healing. It's so good. There's so much there.
Yeah.
Cool, man.
All right.
Thanks, buddy.
See you next time.
Talk to you soon.
Peace.
Hey, everybody. This is Matt Sbrazza. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of The Tangent. If you like what we're doing, don't forget to follow us at @TheTangent_Catholic on Instagram. It's one of the ways that we get our content out to you. So once again, thank you for listening, and see you next time on The Tangent. God bless.